things have turned many times, because from the guinea pig notion, the abuse notion, it's turned around to certain types of medical research representing access, and therefore if you were not eligible for these types of investigations, you were, quote, denied access. I think that came to the fore at about the beginning of the AIDS epidemic. And so it's gone through a lot of transformations. And in fact, I can remember when there was a movement whereby it was said that prisoners shouldn't be denied access to clinical trials in the context of the AIDS epidemic, whereby it was felt that access represented the ability to be treated by newer and perhaps better drugs. So it's been somewhat of a moving sociologic phenomenon. I think our current techniques for regulating human experimentation are pretty thorough. And there's always the risk-reward balance and the changing sociologic notions of what a clinical trial or clinical research represents, all the way from perhaps unnecessary intervention to access to important new techniques of care.
Ask a related, but more specific question. In 1978, the California legislature passed a Protection of Human Subjects in Medical Experimentation Act, and it basically stated that explicit informed consent had to be given to use materials for research. Did that have any, was there any discussion of that among people?
Yeah, well, it still requires interpretation, because even if informed consent is obtained for tissue, let's say surgery, pathologic tissue, the question is what can be done with that tissue. If the informed consent is general, it says, for example, it's scientific research, then some might argue that that it's not sufficiently informed consent on the basis of lack of specificity. If it is specific, then is research delineated or delimited to that specificity? And well, there are many arguments surrounding this. And there are competing rights. I think privacy issues are important, but also there's an imperative to advance medical science.
So on the topic of advancing medical science, can you say a bit about the discovery of HTLV-2 and how you saw that fitting into your work and what that meant for your future?
Well, that was an accident. At UCLA, there were two important cell lines that were developed in my laboratory. One of them was the KG1 cell line, which was myeloid leukemia cell line that proved to be important because the cells responded to colony stimulating factor. So here was a cell line that was a pure cell population that could respond to colony stimulating factor. The cell line turned out to be important for other reasons. It was cell line from which Alpha and Huron, at least one of the Alpha and Hurons was cloned with them. And it was developed by a fellow working in my lab, Phil Kefla, hence the name KG1, Kefla Ability 1. And that cell line has been very useful in biomedical research. It was the second myeloid leukemia cell line. The one previous to that was known as HL60, and that also became an extremely useful cell line. The other thing that came from the KG1 cell line that turned out to be very important in hematology was CD34, which defined both CD33 and CD34, which defined a stem cell and a progenitor population, and CD34 cell selection is a common means of enriching those stem cells. And so, there were many other myeloid cell lines that were developed subsequently, and they've all proved to be, or many of them have proved to be exceedingly useful, and all for different reasons. Some have had the chromosomal abnormalities that have been useful in cloning breakpoints. Their reagents have been very useful for the development of, for example, differentiation agents, first through the mouse cell line, but subsequently with the human myeloid cell lines. So the other cell line that we developed that became well known, we developed a number of cell lines. It's pretty much like cooking, at least in those days, very much like cooking. The development of the cell line was not a rigorous scientific feat. We thought we were pretty experienced cell culturists, and we thought some of our techniques were particularly useful, but these are not the kind of things that are studied formally. I was studying hairy cell leukemia, which is a disease I became interested in because as soon as I got to UCLA, I was formally presented at a conference with a patient with hairy cell leukemia. And I had gotten to know that condition well from my time at the NIH. It was not a well-known entity. I told them that I thought the patient had hairy cell leukemia, but some of the senior hematologists were sort of taken aback. This particular patient was not treated optimally in retrospect. Became very sick, and I got to know him, and I suggested that he have a spleen taken out. Once the spleen was taken out, he had a very long remission. Of his disease, but it was very counterintuitive, because why take the spleen out if the disease is in the blood and the bone marrow? And yet, we don't understand completely the role of splenectomy in hairy cell leukemia. But it was an effective therapy, some of the other more traditional treatments at the time should have been avoided. Because of that, my familiarity with the disease, other patients were referred to me, and I was going to become an expert in the disease. And I guess the first is you get thought of as an expert, and then it becomes a reality because you see so many patients with it. This first patient wasn't the first patient with hairy cell leukemia that I'd seen, but one that I'd become involved with. Everyone was concerned with what the cell origin of hairy cell leukemia, what kind of cell was it? And there were great debates in the literature at the time, and so with some colleagues I undertook study this, and we came to the conclusion that there were B cells based on the fact that they could synthesize immunoglobulin, and we're trying to develop cell lines so we can study in more detail. And then a very famous patient, subsequently to become famous, was referred to me again because I was known as an expert in that area. He's a younger patient than I would normally see. And he had absolutely massive sperm angle, perhaps the biggest sperm I had encountered. And he had otherwise typical hairy cell leukemia. And so we recommended the splenectomy, which was performed, and usual European nephrologist a piece of tissue and trying to make a cell line. And what was unique about this cell line was that it was composed of T cells. Mature T cell lines were not common. Very rare at the time. And this would, sort of contradicted what we thought we had determined with some precision, and that is that the cell of origin of the hairy cell was a B cell. There's a hard to interpret literature of variants of hairy cell leukemia composed of T cells, and we subsequently concluded that he had a T-cell variant of hairy cell leukemia, which I now doubt. In any case, knowing that activated T-cells need colony-stimulating factor, we tested the cell line for the production of colony-stimulating factor, and we found, in fact, that it was a producer of good colony-stimulating activity. And so, ultimately, I decided that we were trying to purify this hormone, that I had that notion of hormones, from the cell line, and that turned out to be very difficult fact. We worked on it many years. We didn't purify mainly purified very tiny amount about 1994, I think. So I've been working on the colony stimulating factor since about 1972. That was a long trip. We found other things in there that we could have found elsewhere, but we were sort of fixated on these T-cell factors. We found a activity we called erythroid potentiating activity, EPA-stimulated erythropoiesis, and we purified that, and ultimately, working with the genetics of David Boston, found it, and that turned out to be TIMP2. What is now known as TIMP2, tissue inhibitor of metallic proteinases too. And so it was a very exciting time because with the impact of molecular biology on more classic biomedical research, there was the ability to clone genes, to express proteins, to do that which previous things aren't doing. And also a lot of surprises. Many people who were purifying proteins thought they were all working with different proteins, found out they were all working with the same one. Or people who thought they were working with the same one, and ultimately they were cloned, found out that they were different. And so erythroid potentiating activity to somewhat of a diversion. But the techniques we used for purifying called EPA we then used turned out to be GM-CSF. We were busy purifying GM-CSF, and I'll finished that story, we finally purified it. Judy Gasson, who was in my laboratory at the time, is from Stockholm, we had a science article. And she is now the director of the Johnson Company Cancer Center at UCLA. It's always rewarding when your young colleagues and students turn out so successful. Phil Kepler is a full professor at UCLA. He's a very successful investigator as well. So in the midst of all this exciting activity, human leukemia virus, retrovirus, was isolated in Bob Galler's laboratory from a T-cell line that came from the patient with a believed to have a type of T-cell leukemia that affects the skin, and this was called HTLV-1. And I was presenting some material, I believe, at a meeting in Europe, and describing the MO cells and what they were producing. And Dr. Gallo felt that this was very reminiscent of the cells that were found in HTLV-1. And ultimately, we sent him material to look for a virus. And he found a retrovirus that had properties that were somewhat different from HTLV-1 and justified it being given a different designation, a different strain. And so we found it HTLV-2. And then at that time, I had a young postdoc, I guess that's redundant. Most postdocs were young. A very skillful Irvin Chen, who just finished his PhD with Howard Terman at McArdle in Wisconsin. And he came to the lab because he wanted to work on the GM-CSF. His background was in retrovirology, given who his mentor was at Wisconsin. But he felt that retrovirology wasn't going places because no human retrovirus had been found. It was extremely bright and hardworking. And here, HTLV-2 pops out of one of our cartridges. So he turned to me one time and he said, what do you think if we try and clone HTLV-2? And I said, well, cloning a virus in those days wasn't a trivial matter at all. You know, there were no kits, there were no way to get reagents, and it was an undertaking. And particularly since my laboratory was certainly not a virology laboratory. So we frankly discussed what that would entail and the competitive nature of it, given Dr. Gallo had a very huge effort in human retrovirology, the National Cancer Institute. The brashness of youth has its advantage. And he said, well, if you're committed to it, then he would be my idea. Of course, I said, well, if you're committed to it. And so we made a mutual commitment, and a very small band of people, and reagents that he got from his mentors at McArdle, which was the key here, and also some molecular insight that Irvin had. We successfully did this. Now, we What Irvin did was to do a saw 3A partial digest. So the issue here was in cloning the virus, you have to pick restriction as I'm putting in the lambda phage, and since you don't know exactly which restriction enzyme to use. And as I recall, HTLV1 had an ECHO-R1 site somewhere in the middle of the genome, I believe that's the case. We came up with the whole marrow genome. And I don't remember the year, but it was a meeting in Keystone when I used to put on about a thesis meeting at the ski resorts. UCLA had an enterprise doing this. And we were sitting in the audience. Irvin was going to present the cloning of HTLV2. Bob Gallo was there, and I think Bob got it first, and showed a half of the genome of HCLV2. And apparently he had to use the ECHO-R1. Now I recall, HCLV1 had no ECHO-R1 site, and HCLV2 had one in the middle of the genome, and I think the second one, and so he cut it now.
Right.
And I was sitting there with Judy Gasson was sitting next. Well, I don't know, there's a competitive nature to this business, and she let out a gasp of delight looking at half the genome. And of course, we published that as a full article in the front of Nature. And, Irvin went on to great success. He's the head of the AIDS Center at UCLA.
So, was this the first cloned human retrovirus?
No, HCLV1 had been cloned, but the cloning of HCLV2 turned out to be important because it's somewhat of a complex genome, not as complex as HIV, but an appreciation for what was then known as the X region, the TAMS region, started to become clear by looking at the homologies between HCLV1 and 2. And then a group at UCLA went on to actually study these, what were then called the X proteins, including Dennis Lehman, who's now the head of hematology and oncology at UCLA. And so an appreciation for those regions. For that region of the HTLV genome and some of the there was some other phenomena. I remember we had a paper in Science that dealt with a transcriptional detail that it had never been seen before. It was an unusual skip in transcription of the viral genome. But it was so exciting in those days that even detail became so that raised all sorts of problems because this virus pops out of a culture, and the question is, does the patient have the virus, or is this just something that appeared in the culture? And ultimately, the NCI group came to UCLA to meet the patient and the family, and we did some studies of our own too, and it turned out that in fact was infected with HCLV2. But no one else in his family was. And the story of HCLV2 is it's a very common virus, and blood banks screen for it, and it's widespread across the world. We don't know what, if any, disease it's associated with. We subsequently found another patient with very sad leukemia who was infected with HTLV-2. And that patient ultimately died. We were able to do a pretty definitive study that showed that his hairy cell leukemia was a B-cell clone, and that he had a clone of T-cells infected with HTLV-2. So, in retrospect, I now believe that the original patient, Mr. Moore, may have had a B-cell hairy cell leukemia and a T-cell clone infected with HTLV-2, and that the cell line we obtained was this HTLV-2 infected T-cell that may have or maybe there's a relationship, but the relationship is not directly causal.
Okay. Alright. Related to this in a different way, some historians of science have talked about the 1970s and the early 1980s at the time when the oncology researchers were jumping on a molecular biology bandwagon, a term that they use. Do you see this as an appropriate term, or what do you... How do you think oncology has reacted to molecular biology? I think it was one of the seminal turning points
in medical research, and certainly in oncology. Molecular biology involved an understanding that individual genes could be isolated and studied, and that proteins could be made, usually from what we call seeding RNA, usually from genome. But proteins could be made from this genetic material, and the leverage of this technology was enormous. In fact, so enormous that to this day I don't believe we fully appreciate what a huge step that was. And, you know, rightfully, the double helix, the early discoveries are seen as seminal events in science. You know, it's equivalent to nuclear fission. Use of an understanding of radioactivity. Huge, because you know, things happen in science at certain intervals that are unpredictable that simply change the whole paradigm of what's possible. You know, there are 1 or 2 billion proteins. Soon, we'll know every gene in the human body. We'll know every gene in every microorganism. And that kind of knowledge has just changed oncology and medicine in general. I should mention that I did a sabbatical in the 70s with Tom Ananias and Caltech, and it sort of changed my life. Tom had constructed the first human genomic library, and the fears at that time, he had to do it for the fetal liver, because if he used some adult tissue, he could be cloning some Andromeda strain. There was great trepidation in the field regarding molecular biology and the dangers of cloning. And my time with Tom, his family, it's been at Harvard for many years now, was seminal in my thinking about what could be done medically. And Tom went on to found Genetics Institute. That was the connection to a biotechnology company. And the other founder was Mark Potashnik, who happens to be here from Wildlife Kettering. But I think by actually working in Tom's lab, he's trained an enormous number of people in science to visualize genes and to see the leverage of molecular technology. I think it's underestimated to this day.
All right, if we could switch gears a little bit to biotechnology and business and medicine. How did you begin consulting in the pharmaceutical company? And how do you think consulting has changed, and how do you think perceptions of consulting has changed in the past 20 years?
Well, that's an interesting question. I have to say, I mean, very little about pharmaceutical companies, except they used to give us pens and little lights and things like that, before it was considered immoral to accept such gifts. I'd say I had almost no contact with the pharmaceutical industry until the advent of biotechnology. And then through my friendship and contact with Tom Maniatis. I knew that that many of the things that we needed to do, particularly in cancer, but in biomedical research in general, required industry. And in the biotechnology industry, I found it very appealing because these were composed mainly of young people, wildly enthusiastic. Genentech with the clone of dye T-shirts. It was an era, something to appreciate. So that was my first contact. And the reality is that people like myself don't make drugs. Nor is that our role. We're not capable of doing it. It's something that requires industry. And it's hard to make heroes out of pharmaceutical companies, but the truth be told, they are the ones that make a lot of the things that are useful to man medically. Now, it's done on a substrate of basic academic science, without question. And I think we've now come to appreciate that that interplay, an appropriate interplay between academic enterprise and for-profit medical industry is in the interest of society. Of course, conducting that properly is a challenge at times. Subsequently, I was a consultant for the Genetics Institute for 7 years. It was our collaboration with them that we cloned the MCSF, and this erythroid potentiating activity. And we did a number of other things, and one of the great advantages we had is we produced GM-CSF in the lab, Judy Gasson, a very tedious process, extremely tedious. And, you know, we got to do some of the early studies, but then Genetics Institute, of course, was able to construct mammalian cell lines that produced huge quantities of it, and then many scientists had this available for their studies, and we benefited equally well. There's always room for abuse in relationships, but I see a lot of the advances in medicine coming from this interaction with the private and public sector biomedical research.
How did the changes in federal technology transfer that were associated with the biotechnology industry change your work? Or did they have any effect? Are you aware of them?
Well, everyone, I think, came across the problems of universities protecting intellectual property, things like inappropriate transfers, and with molecular biology, it's information. It's not information, the gene is enough. You can transfer a gene without transferring any physical substance, simply a sequence. And so there are a lot of things that had to be worked through. And we had one of the early agreements with biotechnology, with more money at UCLA, and subsequently, it's like many other areas where the pendulum has swung to both sides, and now it seems to have gotten somewhere near the middle, where the rights of all parties have to be recognized and accounted for. And universities now are aggressive in protecting their intellectual property, and the pharmaceutical industry has always been aggressive in that area. And I think even with all the contentiousness regarding patents in the biomedical area, the alternative to patents are trade secrets. And that's anathema to academic science, and certainly not generally public interest.
How did your experience with the Moore case change your attitudes towards medical research or towards these kinds of technology transfer issues?
Well, the lawsuit, even one that you win, was unpleasant. And that was unpleasant. And it highlighted the fact that there are unexpected non-cures out there. That one has to be aware of, and it's made biomedical research more complex. And I said that the pendulum has swung to different extremes. And that may have been one of the extremes. I was gun shy for a while thereafter. It's not easy for an academic physician to extensive in depth dealings with lawyers and where the publicity associated with it. And I was a little gun shy, and who knows, maybe to this day I still am. I don't think that's a good thing. I was hesitant to continue to use patient material. For example, the use of the virus to establish cell lines has proved very productive because in looking at genetic disorders, the T cells are usually more reactive cells and it's sometimes better to work with. And so with the virus, we could construct cell lines that the permanent cell line that recapitulate the genetic nature of the individual we obtain. And one of our projects involved pygmies in Central Africa, where we set up pygmy cell lines. One of the anthropologists at UCLA was capable of going to this remote area, and we got informed consent, but sure, one can always make some arguments regarding how to find this particular group of people to believe it. Those cell lines are at the ATCC, and they've been useful in examining examine why or in fact the things are in short expansion.
Is that part of the human-human diversity project at all?
Yeah. I always maintain an interest in growth when I work with endocrinologists.
Okay, well, if we could just turn to the big picture. We haven't spoken much about your more recent work, but looking back over everything that you've done, what would you consider to be your most important contribution to medicine?
Ah, it's hard to know because it's hard to know what in retrospect will be many years from now. The use of colony-stimulating factors in human therapy is so commonplace now that it's hardly considered unusual. And I have the feeling that if it weren't for our work, there were other, certainly other people very skilled in the field. I'm not sure in any way change the course of some important rhythm in life. Maybe in the end, the most important discovery was a more recent one involving vitamin C. What we discovered there was a fundamental mechanism, probably a universal mechanism, by which vitamin C is taken up in cells. It had been known for many years that there was a relationship between vitamin C uptake in cells and glucose. But the nature of that relationship was unknown. And when I came here to Memorial Sloan Kettering, I met Juan Carlos Vera, who began working in my laboratory on the oncologic and immunologic issues that I was interested in. But he started talking to me about his interest in transport. And much like my conversation with Irving Chin many years previously, I guess I'm easily sold. He started to explain to me some theory he was talking about. He told me about the glucose transporters. And I mentioned that this relationship of vitamin C and sugar. And it caught my interest, and we worked on this together, and we ended up proving that, in fact, vitamin C enters cells in the form of dehydroascorbic acid through the glucose transporters. Now, there is another family of transporters that requires energy and is less widely expressed, but every cell has glucose transporters. And I got very excited about it. We published that in Nature and basically showed that dehydroascorbic acid goes right through the glucose transporter, whereas ascorbic acid does not. And this has all sorts of implications. It says many things, among them that extracellular oxidative events lead to the generation of the transportable form of vitamin C. So that the body has some setup whereby oxidation itself facilitates the attention by cells of vitamin C. So I was very attracted to that. We've done many detailed studies that, for those not interested in transport, I'm sure it'll seem boring, but we did an exciting study in vivo where we ascertained the form of vitamin C that crossed the blood-brain barrier in rodents. And we injected ascorbic acid that was labeled, and we injected dehydroascorbic acid, and the dehydroascorbic acid crossed right into the brain, and ascorbic acid didn't. So that led us to the notion that dehydroascorbic acid might used as a therapeutic. Since it involved, we thought that with regard to the brain, its utility might lie in degenerative central nervous system disease. We ultimately licensed to a biotechnology company this technology. We're not neurologists. But if in fact oxidation is a fundamental mechanism of mutation, and indeed aging, and maybe other diseases, degenerative diseases, then vitamin C, being such a potent antioxidant, might have a real role in reversing some of the diseases. And we ourselves would be most interested in, obviously, the prevention of cancer. So I'm enthusiastic about the development of dehydroascorbic acid as a very potent pharmaceutical to regulate the cellular content of vitamin C and thereby regulate the cellular content of antioxidant. Now, of course, everything has to be connected to hematopoiesis. So the reason I became enthused with the glucose transporters is because GM-CSF signals for increased glucose transport. So it wasn't just that my younger colleague was